Hey there, podcast family. T-Bone here to talk about the 3D Dentist Digital Implant Continuum. Are you ready to start placing dental implants, but feeling a bit hesitant and or overwhelmed? I know that feeling. I've been there. Let's change that together. Imagine not just learning about dental implants in a classroom, but actually performing surgeries on real patients right here in North Carolina, guided every step of the way by our expert 3D mentors. This is dental implant learning at its best, using techniques that are safe, predictable, and confidence-boosting. They're exactly what I use in my own practice, so you know they work. Our course goes beyond clinical skills. We prepare you to successfully integrate high-demand implant services into your practice, transforming your career by attracting new patients and elevating your practice. And it doesn't end with the course. Completing our program is just the beginning of a new journey. You'll be a part of a community of confident, skilled dentists with ongoing support to ensure lasting success and growth. After all, this is about mastering a skill that can transform your career, just like it did for me. So, are you ready to take your practice to the next level? Visit www.3d-dentist.com, check out our upcoming sessions, and join us to revolutionize your practice. 3D Dentist is truly committed to helping dentists take control of their practice, finances, and future. Now let's get back to this week's episode.
There's how many trillions of dollars of dry powder sitting uncommitted in a lot of these funds?
And some will argue that there's more money available because the stock market is not a safe bet right now, and dentistry is a safe, relatively safe bet.
So exactly. So you go back multiple decades and you look at private equity in terms of investment thesis for multiple decades. And we've taken a look at a lot of this, and Deloitte and some of them at a high level do studies on this. Healthcare services are always in the top three investment criteria.
We've been misled to believe that dentistry, more specifically the dental business, has to be complicated. Dentistry can be simple, and dentistry should be simple. All right, everybody, welcome back to this week's episode of the Dentistry Made Simple podcast. And if you guys remember on our Dental Business Made Simple framework, one of the things we talk about towards kind of phase four is the concept of exit strategies. Now, traditionally, exit strategies has been thought of a retirement vehicle. And more today, we should actually be thinking of exit strategies much earlier in our career. And my argument would be, if you're in your mid-40s, it's probably time to at least start looking at an exit strategy. Not necessarily saying you got to do it, but you got to start looking at it. And in this week's episode, I'm going to bring Perrin Desports on, and we're going to talk exactly about that. Now, selfishly, we're going to talk about this from what I think is our core audience, which is the single one practice owner, maybe two practice owner, private practice, PPO type of practice. And selfishly, we're doing it because it's something that I'm considering and going through the exercise of. So for those of you that don't know Perrin, Perrin is one of the co-founders of Polaris Healthcare Partners. He is a Washington and Lee University graduate and earned his MBA from the Darla Moore School of Business at the University of South Carolina. We won't hold that against him as a UNC fan. But Perrin has over 25 years in the dental industry, having run three different business units at Patterson Dental over his 15-year career there. So Perrin, how are you doing?
I'm great, Tarun. Thank you so much for having me on today. I've obviously been an admirer and fan of yours through many decades at the Peterson Dental Company, as I like to call it. And I'm glad we're getting a chance to speak and catch up today. It's good to see your face again.
I'm glad to see you too. Now, selfishly, I want to pick your brain. I want to get free consulting coaching on this podcast today. So why don't we start with this? What are the different exit strategies available to the solo practitioner, and why should they consider exit strategies not near end of career, but more maybe mid-career point?
Yeah, I was really grateful that you sort of prefaced this by saying, you know, if you're in your mid-40s or let's call it mid-career, when people think about selling their business or they're forced to think about selling their business, that's kind of a bad time to reach any type of a negotiating table or to reach maximum value for anything you want, be it a house, a business, or otherwise. And I think, you know, when you talk about exit strategy and exit options, it really should be a strategy. I think there are three things you probably want to keep in mind, and I'll try to be sort of congruent or maybe logical for the audience here, you know, since we're on audio. The first thing to kind of think about as it relates to exit options are really what your future desires are. And I say your as the business owner. So is this a scenario where you are wanting to sell your business and walk away? It changes hands, you're done, there's a new owner, you're gone, you're out of the picture altogether. Or is this a scenario where you would like to sell the business and stay on in some capacity, maybe a part-time clinical capacity or an administrative role, maybe stay on as a full-time clinician, you know, and continue to earn income from clinical services, but to reap the value of the business from an equity context? So the first thing is, what's your future desire? Those are what I just described are completely opposite altogether. The second thing would be is, sell to whom? Are you really thinking about selling your practice only in the context of a young associate, a solo dentist who is going to buy you out either immediately or gradually over time? We call that a doctor-to-doctor transaction, typically using bank funds, obviously. Or are you open to selling to a group? It could be a doctor group, or it could be an established DSO. Do you care about who buys your business, solo dentist versus a group buyer? And the third thing to keep in mind, and I'm going to try not to get too wonky on this one, but it's what I would call transaction structure. And we can dig into this a little bit more if you'd like, because there are a lot of rabbit holes to it. But when I say transaction structure, if you are selling your business to a bank-funded young associate, that person's going to borrow a lot of money. The check's going to be payable to you. It's going to be probably an all-cash transaction. You're going to pay off whatever remaining debt you have on the business. You're going to pay Uncle Sam for being your trusted business partner for all these many decades. And you're going to put some dollars in your bank account. So that's a cash transaction, an all cash transaction, typically from a solo buyer. That's really different when you talk about selling the business to a group, potentially. There are all cash offers, but most groups have some type of what we call a hybrid structure, for lack of a better term. It's a component of cash. It's maybe a component that would be an earnout if you stay on in a clinical or leadership capacity. And it's potentially something that might have what we call an equity role, meaning you roll some of the transaction proceeds into ownership in the mother company, and you stay on with them for some period of time until you cash that out. So the three things are, what are your future desires, really? The second thing is, do you care who you sell the business to, solo or group? And the third thing is about transaction structure.
Perfect, Perrin. That answers that pretty well. And something else I want to talk about a little bit later is some tax implications. So now, all right, so let's take a look at this. So when we go through this, what I keep hearing all this EBITDA and X valuations and 20X valuations and the, you know, doctor to doctor valuation versus a doctor to group valuation. You know, what does the dentist, the individual dentist, need to know on the reality of what they can expect in evaluation of a doctor to doctor sale versus a group / DSO sale?
Yeah, we could record a podcast series on this one if you wanted to. So again, I'm going to try to keep it informative, but as light as I possibly can. So doctor to doctor transactions, which is the way the industry has been
majority of the years.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, what is it and how does it come to be? Well, there are a lot of CPAs and dental practice brokers and people representing sellers to sell their business in a doctor to doctor trade. What that is a valuation that is somewhat, or a sale that is fairly dependent upon bank funds to get it done. Yeah. So the young associate's going to borrow money from a bank and going to buy out the senior owner. Banks make lending decisions a number of different ways. And again, I'm going to try not to get too wonky here, but there's a methodology or a calculation called loan to revenue. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, typically it maxes out probably around 80% of revenue with some working capital, maybe 85%, something like that. So if the revenue of the business is $3 million,
for example.
Okay. So $3 million and an 80% number on that is about 2.4 on loan to revenue. All right. The second thing banks make lending decisions on is something called debt service coverage ratio. And there won't be a test on this, I promise. But debt service coverage ratio is the same thing for somebody buying your practice as it would be for you and me buying a house. All right. So the bank wants to know that we cash flow from however we generate cash, that we're able to satisfy our debt obligations with some window of variability or fudge to it, right? Some margin for error. The bank wants to know that you, based on your personal lifestyle and all the other debts you have, can satisfy the additional business debt that comes along with it. If you are selling your practice to a bank-funded young buyer, I say young, a bank-funded solo dentist, that is like an owner-operator model, right? So the person who's guaranteeing the loan is going to be probably the primary economic engine in the business, going to do most of the clinical work, is going to be in it 5 days a week. And if that thing starts to take a nosedive, they're going to die trying, right? That is their full endeavor. That sort of valuation methodology, whether you use asset values, discounted cash flows, loan to revenue, percentage of collections, all of that mishmash tends to land in the 60 to 80% of collections window. All right. And that's why most of traditional solo practices value somewhere between about 60 to 80% of collections.
Now, what about what I'm hearing nowadays of markets going at the 100% valuation and things like that?
So a lot of that is driven by the owner cash flow characteristics of that business. Mm-hmm. It's probably a higher revenue business with a reasonable fixed cost basis. And so if somebody does buy out the senior seller, the business probably cash flows pretty wonderfully. And the cash flows are probably pretty secure.
Okay.
Meaning they might not change from one owner to another. We can talk about, clinicians such as yourself that do like expanded clinical functions and things like that, because that's a different element of risk that I think we want to talk about in a second. But the other thing that's driving the percentage of revenue numbers higher are the group buyers.
The competition.
Yes, absolutely. So again, much like selling a house, what's it worth? Well, it's worth what the market will bear, right? And if you have a high value practice that cash flows wonderfully, group buyers look at practices in small groups as a multiple of EBITDA in terms of valuation. And again, there won't be a test on this, but EBITDA is normalized cash flow. And what a group buyer wants to know is if they buy that business, what is the likelihood of the cash flows continuing indefinitely into the future? Or what is the probability that they could expand the cash flow out of the business by either adding an associate, increasing insurance reimbursement rates, recapturing specialty procedures, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they are able to arguably pay more for a practice than a bank-funded solo buyer would be, because they bring more resources to the table to generate greater cash flows in the future. And practices, when they measure as a multiple of EBITDA, are probably going to value more highly than those that would be simple doctor-to-doctor transactions.
So, all right. So for comparison's sake, and let's just use prototypical, not like the one-offs on the top and the bottom line.
Yeah.
What you're telling us is, on a doctor-to-doctor sale using bank funds on a solo sale, you typically can expect anywhere from 60 to 80% in certain markets, maybe even up to 95 to 100% of annual revenue. Okay. Now, when we go to a doctor to group practice to group sale, and again, we're talking about the solo one doctor, you know, one location practice, not necessarily one doctor, but one location practice selling to either a doctor run group or a true DSO group. Now, suddenly we don't go necessarily on a percentage of revenue, but we go on a multiple of EBITDA, which is essentially, for better words, profit.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hey, podcast family, T-Bone here. Are you a dentist looking to elevate your practice and profits? Then pay close attention. Introducing the 3D Business Mastermind, the dental business coaching program designed for dentists who want to see real results. I've walked the path of practice ownership for nearly 25 years. I know your challenges. I felt your pain. This is your opportunity to overcome the chaos, the busyness, and the financial frustrations of owning a dental practice. Imagine a dental practice where your appointment book is highly productive, doing the dentistry you enjoy, your team is self-motivated, and your profits keep climbing. That's what the 3D Business Mastermind is all about. In this exclusive mastermind, you'll join a league of ambitious dentists driven to elevate their practices. You'll gain access to proven strategies, personalized coaching, and a community that understands your journey. So if you're ready to supercharge your dental practice and enjoy the success you deserve, visit www.3d-dentists.com and take the first step towards a brighter future in dentistry by filling out the 3D Business Mastermind application. Now, let's get to this week's episode.
It's pre-tax operational cash flow. So it's pre-tax and pre-debt service when you calculate EBITDA.
And what's a typical multiple that we're seeing in today's world on these doctor to group DSO situations?
So the rule of thumb, just like I said, it fell in the typically 60 to 80% of collections range for the bank funded piece of it. In a multiple of EBITDA context, solo practices typically sell for somewhere between 3 to 5 times EBITDA. Now, I, for the sake of your audience, I do not want anybody out there to say, okay, 60 to 80% of collections equals 3 to 5 times EBITDA. They do not. All right. Those are two separate calculations, and I'm just giving you some parameters in which they fall. You will almost always see practices, solo practices, listed or the sale value listed as a percentage of collections, because that's what the market understands. That's kind of what the market standards are on a doctor-to-doctor transaction. But a group is going to value that practice as a multiple of EBITDA before they pull the trigger on it.
All right. So even though you just said that, what does 3 to 5x typically equal to in terms of a percentage of revenue?
It is probably somewhere in the 70 to 100% of collections window. Okay. It really does matter what the EBITDA, the operating cash flows of the business are. So I'll give you a quick example on a solo practice that we represented that was about $2.5 million in revenue. It was a single doctor, five op practice, did a lot of expanded function dentistry, sedation dentistry, and some things like that, CERAC and everything. Very profitable business. You know, $2.5 million in revenue for one person out of five ops is strong by any stretch of the imagination. That's a business that a group buyer ended up buying for close to 180% of revenue.
Okay. So that was probably a multiple of 6-7x, I would imagine.
It was like a little bit over 5, actually. So it wasn't too far out of the window that I mentioned, the 3 to 5x.
So along these lines, and I'm asking these from personal free advice here.
I know where you're coming from, Drew. Okay. You no disclaimer necessary. Yeah.
Well, I want my audience to know.
Yeah. Of course.
So if somebody's giving you is it possible and realistic in certain markets, such as the Raleigh market, to start seeing multiples not to reach 5 to 7, 8x for solo practice, for individual locations? Or should that be a red flag?
I Is it possible? I'm not going to say it's impossible. I think it would be, there'd have to be a lot of compelling reasons for somebody to pay that type of a multiple for a traditional type of a solo practice. When I say traditional, you know, if ADA average is somewhere around 700 to 750,000 in revenue, maybe, you know, up to let's say $1 million in revenue, a multiple such as that, we would probably want to talk a little bit more deal structure, because I think the structure of the deal influences the EBITDA multiple. So it's sort of a downstream argument. But I think that would be an anomaly, maybe. But if it were a practice that were technically a solo practice, but it was a larger solo practice, something that might be 10 to 12 ops, it could have three associates in it. Yeah, you know, and this is a business that in and of itself might generate $1 million in EBITDA. Well, that's a different kettle of fish. Okay. You know, not a traditional solo practice.
So let's pause on that. Let's talk about that for a second. Okay. So what I just heard was I personally stop saying solo practitioner and keep saying single location, because what we preach, I don't use the word preach, what we focus on at 3D Dentist is moving to a model of single location, multiple dentists. So another advantage of moving to a single location, multiple dentists is suddenly your revenue goes up, your EBITDA, your profit margin or your cash flow goes up, and therefore the valuation of your practice goes up. And to kind of help listeners understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is it's really less risk. Because it's not dependent on a single, like if it's me and just me in my practice and I break my arm, that's a problem for the buyer of my practice, correct? Especially 100%. If you structure it for me to stay on. Whereas right now, if I break my arm and I got two other dentists that can poke the load for 80, 90, 100% of it, that's a less risk for the potential buyer, correct?
That's completely correct. And let me just build on your point for a second here. We are huge fan. We at Polaris are huge fans of what I call the large footprint single location. Exactly what you're talking about. It's arguably 12 to 20 ops. It's multiple providers. You're able to take complete advantage of your fixed cost structure. There's probably more opportunity to stay open, extended hours, and even extended days, Saturdays and otherwise. So it's typically a business that is not provider dependent. They do cash flow wonderfully. The volume out of it gives you some negotiating capability with either suppliers, labs, insurance companies, et cetera. And these are businesses that, you know, when you start getting close to or ticking over $1 million in EBITDA, you do get increases in the turns on the multiple. And this kind of goes back to your other question about, would you ever see a single location go 5 to 7 times EBITDA? When we start talking about a single location that's generating around $1 million in EBITDA, then yes, you have the addition, you have the opportunity to push the multiple a turn or two higher.
Okay. So more advantages of getting the associate other than just being able to take more time off and focus on the procedures you want to focus on and all of those things. Yeah.
Well, there's that too. But I mean, that's part of being a business owner. You know, you built the business and they're the beneficiary of the risk that you took. So it's okay for, in my book, to take some time and do the procedures you want.
All right. So here's something I ran into. So about 2.5 years ago, I started looking in, not because I want to sell or I want to transition, but I'm a big believer in what I call going through the exercise. You can't make a decision if you never explore what the possibilities are, right? And so the first time I entertained having my practice evaluated, the group and or the accountants I had value it, they laughed at my P&L statement because it was an absolute mess. Okay. So if somebody's considering going through the exercise or going down this road, what can they do? What can the single location practitioner do to get best prepared to present yourself for the best offer and valuation? It's kind of like when you go to sell a car, they always say, get it clean and detailed and do all of those things because you want to present a shining object.
Sure. Sure. So this is another really good question, and thanks for asking this one, because it is, we try to impress upon prospective clients that selling the business should be a process and not an event. So let me kind of unpack the process for you a little bit. You know, first question, when people like they have their last bad day and they're just done and they want out. And the question is, well, how long do you think it'll take? How quickly can you sell my business? Because I want to shoot my assistant, my hygienist. I'm done with it. I had a bad patient. So they're at the end of their rope. Bad time to sell a business. So the process of going to market and closing on the transaction is probably between about 4 and 9 months on average, depending on who the buyers are, the complexity, all that kind of jazz, right? So you should probably rely on 4 to 9 months of a window of actually committing to go to market and closing the transaction. That being said, I would tell you that 2 years before you're really ready to have a transaction, you ought to have somebody audit your books, take a look at the business, assess where the risks reside and where the cash flows are. Try to understand the complexity of the business because businesses are dynamic animals. And whether it's a bank-funded solo buyer or a private equity-backed group type of a buyer, it's going to be a lengthier process to get maximum value out of it. And maximum value also really is dependent upon the seller. So what you consider to be maximum value might be different than the way I look at it. If you are looking to sell your business, you know, wash your hands of it, go buy an island.
They're going to pay you less.
Exactly. Because now they're taking on all, now the buyer is taking on all the risk. Whereas, so maximum value to you is maybe quality of life and being done with all the headaches. Whereas maximum value to me might be, hey, I've taken this thing as far as I can go. And I'd love to hand off some of the headaches about it, but I don't know that I'm really ready to retire. I like doing the clinical work that I do. I wouldn't mind being paid for that. Maybe go from 4 days a week to 2 days a week, but I'd like to get some cash right now. And I'd like to maintain an equity position that I could have a second bite of the apple 3 to 5 years down the road. So those types of mentality or you know, how you define maximum value can be different seller to seller. And if you think about this 2 years leading up, you're not under any pressure at that point, kind of like you weren't when you went through the exploratory process.
That made it great for me, by the way, because I felt like no problem. It would take a year to get this stuff cleaned up.
Exactly. And it one of the beauties of our business, not just to openly plug about it, but we have a consulting side of our business. We have a sell side advisory side of our business. So if there's low-hanging fruit, expense management, things to shore up, whatever it may be, you know, we kind of look at it through the lens of a consultant, not a sell-side advisor. And then we say, look, you know, these are some of the areas that you probably want to shore up and really fix and tidy up, wash the car before you take it to market. And then you're probably going to show better in the marketplace and hopefully command a higher value. And then we can also educate people that, you know, okay, when we close the transaction, what do you want life after that liquidity event to look like? Do you want to be the director of business development for Central North Carolina for XYZ group practice or DSO? Or do you want to be playing golf 6 days a week? You know, that differentiates the risk on behalf of the buyer. Less risk on behalf of the buyer usually means a higher premium.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, podcast family. T-Bone here, bringing you our newest live patient implant training, Full Arch Express. For dentists already placing implants and ready to level up and continue building their implant practice, this is the golden ticket. We're diving deep into Full Arch Implants, the hottest game changer in implant dentistry. In this program, we tackle both overdentures and all-on-X fixed hybrids, mastering techniques that are essential for modern, comprehensive dental care. It's about getting your hands on the tools and techniques that will replace the doubt and fear with confidence and predictability. Here's the kicker. There's live patient training right here in North Carolina. You're not just learning theories. You're in the operatory doing real work on real patient from start to finish, guided one-on-one by our expert 3D mentors. You'll learn the nuances of each approach, ensuring you can cater to a wide range of patients to maximize revenue. Speaking of revenue, with me, you know it's not just about the clinical skills. We're bringing business into this aspect too, teaching you how to integrate these advanced services profitably into your practice. So are you ready to rise up to the top in implant dentistry? Join us at the Full Arch Express. This isn't just another course, it's a career-defining leap. Head to www.3ddentist.com to enroll in our next session. 3D Dentist is truly committed to helping dentists take control of their practice, finances, and future. Now, back to this week's episode.
All right, so so I'm going to go through the things that we had to clean up and just laugh at me. One is about 3 years ago, I was running my speaking business through my practice as through that tax ID number. That became a problem, especially as the speaking and education business became significant.
Sure.
So we needed to clean that out because the people had lots of questions. The group I was looking at and the buyers I was looking at then had lots of questions about the veracity of that information. Was I hiding stuff, not hiding stuff? Then I had to work on cleaning out or pre-categorizing my my potential taxable personal events through the business. And we all know that one of the benefits of a small business owner is that you can questionably or rightfully run certain things through your business, things like cars, phones.
Yeah, I've heard that before. Yeah,
mattresses, exactly. You know,
yeah,
furniture.
Sure. Yeah.
Clothing,
lawn care, you know, tickets care. To this pro sports team, yeah, kids,
all that stuff, and I needed to get that cleaned out because that was dirty. I mean, when I say dirty, not illegal, but it was things that kept muddying the water.
Yep.
The other thing I learned through the first phase of going through this was I was keeping too much inventory of certain things that was affecting my EBITDA. So, for example, you know, when you're the only owner, when you're a solo location, I like to keep, and we do a couple of 300 implants a year. I like to keep 100 implants in stock. And what I realized through my first go around with this, that 100 implants or $30,000-$40,000 was times 5x is cost me $150,000 in potential valuation. And that either becomes a negotiating point with the potential buyer, or you just got to clean it up to get there. The other thing I noticed for me was I prepaid for a lot of my long-term marketing. So I would have a one-time expense. You know, maybe I did that at the end of the year for 2022. I paid in 2021 to decrease my taxable income. But then if I was selling based on a rolling average, then again, that affected my EBITDA. And it'd be one more thing that you'd have to talk to somebody about, have a negotiation about. So those were the things that I learned in this process was in helping me keep my books very clean.
Yeah. All points well taken. And look, I mean, if you're working with a sharp sell side representative, mm-hmm. they're going to try to tease out all of that, mm-hmm. You know, and normalize things to the best of their ability, because their job is to present the business in the best light. And also, frankly, to make it easy on the buy side to come to the same conclusion around valuation that you're representing the business at. Now, when you start getting into, you know, maybe less adept sell side representation, and they just present the business the way it is, and it's up for the buy side to figure it out, then, you know, that becomes a problem. And you mentioned one thing kind of in passing that I really want the audience to latch on to, which is, you know, times five, you said times five on the EBITDA multiple. What you meant there is that every dollar of savings or every dollar of profitability that you can show is worth five, six, seven times at the deal table. All right. So all of a sudden, these little rounding errors of, you know, a couple of grand here, a couple of grand there, they add up to six figures in a hurry.
Yep.
And, you know, if you have personal expenses run through the business, and most people do. As long as your accountant's okay with it, right, and can justify it, then you have the liberty to do that. The owner benefit piece, and I think it's just important to be able to have them categorized to make it easy mm-hmm. to represent them for what they are and what they aren't. And that's not to say that if you have a spouse or a child or you know, an extended family member or something on the payroll, Are they really mission critical to the business? And
Right.
if they're not, then categorize them one way. But if you lost them, you would have to replace them.
Yep.
You know, so that's somebody that is a legitimate part of the pay structure of the business.
One of the other things I found interesting as well, and I'm trying to give people pointers because I'm still in the process. I'm still evaluating if and what my options are, was they wanted to normalize rent because I own my building and I was paying, I was purposely paying below market rent for any number of reasons. And so that wouldn't be the rent that I would charge in the event that somebody else purchased it. So they did an add back or add away, whatever the technical term is for it, to normalize rent.
Negative adjustment.
Yeah, negative adjustment. So these are all the things that I think, if you're serious about looking at any type of sale, whether it's, you know, private to private or private to group, I think you got to clean your business up because, man, it's worse than getting a loan because they ask for all kinds of documentation through their due diligence. And rightfully they should, because they're giving you a lot of money. And at the end of the day, the value of business isn't in assets. It's in goodwill and all of that. And so sure, they don't need to buy an office with equipment that they can barely sell. So along this line, Perrin, the last question here is, okay, hey, listen, two parts of this one. Why would anybody, if the valuations are what I'm seeing in our market here in Raleigh, the valuation of private to private sale versus private to group sale is about a 50%, 40 to 50% difference in valuation. Why would somebody not sell to a group? And then what are the pitfalls and strings attached to selling to a group? Because there's got to be some strings attached to it.
Yeah. So this is a good question. And a lot of it does come back to transaction structure. So let me see if I can rattle through this in some logical sequence. There's an old adage in the world of M&A that says something to the effect of, I'll let you set the price if I get to set the structure.
Right.
All right. So
I'll give you $10 million for this if I only got to give you 10% down, and I'll give you the other 10% over 50 years while you're dead.
Yeah. So anytime people come to me and they say, you know, well, I want 10X for my business, it tells me a couple of things. One, you really are focused on the wrong thing, because if you want 10X for your business, I'll gladly give you that every day. You may not like the structure that I put forward in terms of a 20-year earnout or something like that, but I'll give you 10X for it. You know, so what are we really after here? And if you, this is, again, you want your advisor to be able to be educational and credible about the way transactions are structured if it's not a traditional cash-based doctor-to-doctor transaction, okay? So the devil's in the details, as they say. So let's go back to, you know, your question about if group-based transactions are 140 to 150% of doctor-to-doctor trades in the Raleigh mm-hmm. market, why would you'd be crazy not to sell to a group?
In
theory, maybe not. So the first thing is, not all groups are alike. I know they get painted with the same mm-hmm. brush, but they're truly not alike.
Typically, and I'm talking a negative brush, not always a negative brush, by the way.
Right. I mean, there are some... some have hard-earned reputations.
Yeah,
let's put it that way. Okay, but you know, we know a lot of them, and we used to say, look, you know, you've seen one DSO, you've seen one DSO.
That's
all right. They really are different, and you owe it to yourself not to paint them with a broad brush, because some can create highly advantageous outcomes for people. So the next thing would be, you know, I go back to this thing about selling the business and what's your time frame after the liquidity event. Well, if somebody is really late stage of their career and they just want to be done, any group buyer is going to ask the seller to stay on for some period of time.
What's typical in that situation?
I tell people to bank on 2 years.
Okay.
It could be less. It could be more, depending upon the buyer.
What number becomes concerning to you as when you're on a sell side advisor?
So, I mean, we don't see too many of them that would be beyond about 3 years. Okay. And I think the reason for that, here's another kind of, this is a broad generalization on transaction structure, but what you find is that an accountant would typically say, you're crazy to sell the business in mid-career. Look at the cash flows in perpetuity and how much you're going to give up to sell the business now. And I get it, but you and I both know that no business stays the same one year to the next.
There's also a value of getting $1 million in cash today and every 8 years, 9 years, letting it double. My question is, if you have 20 years left in your career, that in theory is two doubling cycles. So if your business isn't worth $3 million 20 years from now, you've screwed yourself.
Yeah. So exactly. So it's the alternative investment thesis there. And when we run, you know, transaction structures for somebody that not only is evaluating different buyers in the structures, but also should I or should I not sell now? You know, we kind of benchmark some with some degree of conservative cash flow projection over about 5 years versus the sale, reinvestment, and equity role. And I think that, you know, those curves kind of cross around 5 years down the road. Okay. So, you know, again, if somebody says, look, I want to be out, I want to be done, I only want to stay on for 90 days to help transition.
Then you're going to do doctor to doctor pretty much.
Exactly. Exactly. But if they say, look, you know, I'd like to stay on in a limited, you know, clinical capacity. I'd like to take some chips off the table. I'd like to reap what would be arguably maximum value for the business today. And I'm probably going to be done and gone in 3 to 5 years. Then that sets up wonderfully well for a group type of a buyer. And then you're evaluating different groups.
Aaron, if I told you I wanted to stick around for 10 to 12 years, what would you suggest selling to a group?
I could answer every question with it depends. So here's the way I would answer that, knowing you and knowing the market that you're in. And I think that both of those have a huge degree of influence in what I would tell you. And that is as follows. If you're going to stay on for 10 years in a limited clinical capacity, or 10 or more years in a limited clinical capacity, we'd want to get really, really hard and fast numbers on the equity buyout piece up front, because that in that alternative investment piece and the doubling, you know, rule of 72 every, you know, 8 to 9 years on reasonable returns really does matter a lot at that point. However, knowing you the way I do and knowing the North Carolina market the way I do, North Carolina is one of the last frontiers as it relates to consolidation. And there are a lot of high value businesses in our world. And you and I know most of them from having lived in these markets forever. And, you know, there are a lot of bell cow practices commanding high value from DSOs that are looking to enter marketplaces and are willing to pay a premium for it. So a business like yours, I have to believe, would value extremely highly in that context. The second piece that's arguably harder to put a finger on, but could make you even more valuable and credible, is the name brand you've created and following you've created for yourself. And that's part of that speaking business that you had to unentangle from before. So if somebody's looking at saying, look, I'd like to enter the North Carolina market, and I got to find three cornerstone clinicians or businesses to buy over the entire state of North Carolina, and I need a couple of Pied Pipers to help me, you know, draw followers, you would, you know, you'd be clinician and director of business development in the RTP market probably. Okay. And that would command a premium, I would think.
All right. So along those same lines, I know we wouldn't keep this short. Now I have lots of questions. along those same lines, I've had friends tell me, sell now because the valuations are going to go down when the competition goes down, or the friend, quote unquote, frenzy, or the market, you know, going down and things like the stock market going down. What's your take on some of that?
You know, I can argue both sides of it. I mean, here are a couple of things to keep in mind. All private equity backed enterprise level DSOs use debt leverage to grow. So they start with some amount of equity capital and they go to a bank and they borrow a ton of money to do that. It's usually in an interest only loan structure.
At a pretty high interest rate a lot of times.
At a variable rate, yeah. So when their cost of capital goes up, it's reasonable to conclude that the valuation they're able to pay goes slightly down because their costs are going up, all right? I mean, so that's rational, that's reasonable. That being said, there's how many trillions of dollars of dry powder sitting uncommitted in a lot of these funds?
And some will argue that there's more money available because the stock market is not a safe bet right now, and dentistry is a safe, relatively safe bet.
So exactly. So you go back multiple decades and you look at private equity in terms of investment thesis for multiple decades, and we've taken a look at a lot of this, and Deloitte and some of them at a high level do studies on this. Healthcare services are always in the top three investment criteria of all private equity groups. And if you look at healthcare services in their entirety, arguably, which is the most highly advantageous sector of healthcare services right now? It's the one that you and I are sitting in.
Yeah, it's
All right.
dentistry.
So,
Mental health being very close behind
yeah, I
or
mean, and my
right ahead.
wife's an ophthalmologist, so ophthalmology optometry doesn't lag too far behind that. But so, and you think about, the bulk of the profession of dentistry is general dentist, and a hygiene component plays a large catalyst to that. And it makes general dentistry practices, as long as they're fairly well run, very sticky. And I mean, customer retention, patient retention, so it limits the downside risk for investors. And I think that, even though we're at arguably like 50% market consolidation, or less than 50% is traditional solo dentist, solo location, the ADA's done some studies on this. It's still a highly advantageous market to be in. And I think there's still ample runway ahead of us in terms of valuation, as long as the US economy and the
Yeah, as
global
long as the
economy.
world doesn't
So,
go shit the bed.
yeah, I mean, short of a global pandemic and,
And even that
18%
turned out to
inflation.
be great for us.
Yeah, for a little while it did, right? And I'm gonna vote for Jimmy Carter in the next presidential election just to bring back 18% inflation cycles again. So, there, if you take all that out of it, I mean, I think you just look at the business of dentistry and the way the industry's situated right now. I think it's a great time to potentially be in a sell side window. But I think to take maximum advantage of it, you can't look at it like an event. You really need to think about it in a probably 3 to 8 year continuum, to reap what would arguably be maximum value for it.
All right, Perrin, I got one more question for you. But before we do that question, tell us a little bit about how people can get in touch with you, what Polaris does, and kind of give us your little pitch on that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. So I'll burn up the lion's share of our time with telling the company story, right? So first and foremost, our business is called Polaris Healthcare Partners, and our URL is polarishealthcarepartners.com. And I like to say that we searched for the longest unclaimed URL, and I think we found it. So if you type in polarishealthcarepartners.com, you'll find us. We are a strategic consulting and sell-side advisory firm that focuses exclusively with group dental practices. So a lot of these solo doctor-to-doctor type transactions we're talking about, we understand them really well. We don't represent a lot of solo dentists in the sell side market unless they have arguably a higher value practice and they're willing to sell to a group buyer. So if your audience is open to, if their business is higher value and they're open to a group buyer, we probably would be a pretty good tool in the toolbox for them, I'd like to say. For those that are looking to build group practices, entrepreneurs such as yourself, if you wanted to add a second, third, fifth location, we are consultants that work on growth strategy with entrepreneurs. So a lot of the dental practice management consultants that you and I know really well that focus on, I don't know, case acceptance and hygiene retention and scheduling efficiency and all that kind of good stuff, we don't do any of that. We work with entrepreneurs who are looking to buy or build additional locations. We help them, galvanize their leadership team. We teach them how to grow businesses. We teach them how to maximize EBITDA for both valuation purposes and to be able to borrow more money from banks to grow. We help them with associate equity models. So how do you bring an associate into the business and allow him or her to become an owner in the business? And then ultimately, at some point, we work ourselves out of a job. Our goal is not to be with them as a consultant for 10 years. What did you learn? But you know, to really teach them how to run a better business and to have more confidence doing it. And hopefully once they reach some level of success and they want to take some chips off the table, they'll come back to us to represent them in the sell side market too.
Perfect. Thank you, Perrin. And for the listeners, I've known Perrin a long time, super smart. If you can't figure out he's super smart in this stuff, you're not ready to sell your practice or optimize your practice for this stuff. All right. So my last, and honestly, in my opinion, for me personally, most important question is, what does an ideal deal structure look like for somebody that says, you know what? I want to get the most value. I want to go to a group. I want to stick around 3, 4, 5 years. I'm entrepreneurial in a sense that I want to have a second bite or even a third bite, but let's focus on the second bite. What are the red flags and what does a good deal structure look like there?
Okay.
Advantageous deal structure.
So a lot of questions in that. And let me sort of take it from the top and maybe work my way backwards on this one. So think about, for your audience, think about selling your business twice.
Okay.
The first sale of the business, you get a some amount in cash, and whatever is left over is rolled into an ownership structure.
Like a stock purchase.
Exactly. Yeah. So you go from being 100% owner of Raleigh Dental Arts. I give you 60% of the value of that in cash. You can do with it whatever you want. And the remaining 40% is in the Perrin Desports Enterprise DSO that's all over the Southeast. So you are rolling some of the proceeds of the sale into ownership in the parent company.
But let me be one quick. You're not an equity owner of your practice anymore. You are a stockholder, correct? So you're not entitled to dividends typically of the operations of your practice.
Well, again, it depends on the buyer. Now, since you mentioned dividends, here's a rule of thumb. Let me just tie that off real quick. Typically, group buyers do not declare dividends because they are reinvesting the cash that's available from a dividend into a growth mechanism for the business, usually to buy more practices. Okay. So do not rely on cashing out dividends from a practice level or a sub DSO level or something like that. Some do, but most do not. Okay. Right. So the thing here on the equity role piece, being a stockholder of ABC DSO, is that you want the value of the shares you hold to grow every bit as much as if you owned Apple or Google or any other stock, right? The reason we buy them is because we think the best days of the company are ahead of it. This is the same thing, but it's ownership in a privately held company, not a publicly traded company. So the second piece to keep in mind beyond ownership in the parent company is that almost all of these enterprise level DSOs are private equity backed. Mm-hmm. And a private equity group is an investment vehicle. And they may own a group dental practice, and they may own a hotel chain, and they may own a sports equipment manufacturing company or whatever else, right? They're just looking for their best available return on their investment. We like to say private equity groups rent businesses. They don't own businesses.
3 to 5 years.
Okay. So what that means is a private equity backer of an enterprise level group is going to invest in that group. They're going to hopefully improve that group. When I say improve, I mean improve profitability. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to exit their position with probably another private equity type buyer to buy them out at some point in time. And that's called a recap. Mm-hmm. When the business recaps, meaning private equity group A sells the enterprise level DSO to private equity back group or to private equity buyer B, then those of you like Tarun Agarwal that rolled your 40% are able to pull the proceeds out.
Or a portion of your proceeds out.
A portion of it, if you want to leave some in, some are obligated to leave in, others can cash out completely. Again, it kind of depends on the buyer. The key to this is, When ABC DSO buys Raleigh Dental Arts, how long has the private equity group owned ABC DSO? Is it early in their stage of investment or is it late, meaning closer to recap? If it's earlier, it's like for you getting a stock on an IPO.
Right. 3 to 5 years.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the rule of thumb, 3 to 5 years. And pre-pandemic, it was arguably 2 to 3 years because the returns were so good. So when you're able to cash out upon a recap, that's really the doubling or tripling potentially the value of your equity that you rolled in. And sometimes that second bite of the apple can be worth far more than the first bite. So it comes back to risk tolerance for you. How much cash do you need when you sell your business the first time? Do you need, 80% of it in cash? Do you need 60%? How much do you believe in the buyer? Meaning, how much do you want to roll in terms of percentage? And where is the buyer in terms of the investment hold cycle along the way?
I want to clarify one thing for the listeners. So some people say, how does a second bite equal more money? And here's the basics of that is if Perrin's a DSO, let's pretend, okay, you buy my business for 5x, let's call it, okay? And then when you group and package and consolidate 20, 30, 40, 50 offices together, you're going to sell at a multiple of 10, 12, maybe even 15x. So now your 40%, 20%, 30% stock gets valued at what bought in at 5x. Now gets valued at 10x, 12x, 15x. So sometimes the second bite of the apple can be equivalent to the initial sale or even more than the initial sale. And that's the allure to group practices. And especially if it's a well-run group and they're got that 2 to 3 year window and they're willing to invest and inject money into your business and operationalize it, then they're going to increase your EBITDA and they're going to increase your multiple. And I'm not trying to be a sales pitch for DSOs. I'm just trying to be a sales pitch of knowing your options so you can make the best decision that works best in your career. And what I'm seeing is too many people wait till they're 60 and the only option available to them is to exit and walk away. Whereas if they sold it when they were 50, they could have yielded 200-300% of their practice valuation.
That's
Is
exactly
that
right.
pretty much in a nutshell?
Yeah, and you got to impress upon the point that every group is different. Every enterprise level buyer is different based on their longevity, based on the whole cycle, and some have different equity structures where your rolled equity would reside in their current cap table, which that's a totally wonky argument to go down. But it's once again, if you're going to entertain selling your business to a group to reap whatever you consider to be maximum value, you really want a sell side advisor that understands how to read the tea leaves, understands what you want, understands your risk tolerance, and knows the buy side market to find the best partner for you because none of this is guaranteed.
So, all right. So one last thing. I keep coming up with things. I apologize, Barry.
You're going to run out of one last here before
Well,
much longer, but
that's a people that have heard me speak or when they run my seminars, that's why
and
I'm
another
still
thing,
going.
and another thing, and
Yeah.
another thing.
You mentioned DSO and sub DSO. Should you be concerned if the buyer wants to keep your equity in the sub DSO?
Not necessarily. A lot of them have sub DSOs for really legitimate reasons, and a lot of that is driven by the differences in potential differences in legal structures from one state to the next. So if you have a if you sell your business to an enterprise level buyer and they're in 20 different states, they very well could have 20 different sub DSOs or even sub DSOs within certain states. It
Or even
doesn't make
practice level DSO.
Yeah, I mean you could have that. It doesn't that's why I say each buyer is slightly different in terms of their overall equity structure, how it rolls up into the cap table. The other thing is that some may limit the amount of upside that you have based on valuation multiple. You mentioned selling your business at 5 times and the parent company recaps at 10 times. Well, it doesn't necessarily always mean that you're the beneficiary of that 5 to 10 spread there. And others say, hey, look, we're an earlier stage DSO. We only have 50 practices, but for that reason, since you're getting in early with us, all of the equity trades at the same level of the cap table, and there is no difference. And that's a benefit to you for being in early. There's more risk with that, right? I mean, that's so there's risk and reward on all this. And there again, no return is guaranteed. You may choose an enterprise level buyer that's been around for decades. That's about as safe as bet as they come, but maybe the return on your dollar is 1.25 instead of the 3x that right. you could have gotten with a riskier venture potentially. So
would you encourage people, I know it's going to be depends. Would you encourage people to take as much off the table on the front end or roll more in? If the DSO, the buyer gives you the opportunity to say, we can give you 60% or even 80% upfront. What would your general answer to that be?
My general answer would be that I've seen far better second bite outcomes for sellers than I have those that didn't materialize. So, you know, it depends on kind of where you are in life and what your fixed cost structure is, honestly. You know, how much can you afford to risk? It, very rarely do we ever see these businesses go to zero.
Okay.
All right. I mean, they still cash flow wonderfully. Some may underperform relative to others. And that's why I say your risk tolerance. But, you know, knowing the buy side we do as well as we do, and probably, you know, what we feel like our gut level tells us over the next 5 to 10 years, I think dentistry is a really good bet. And I think if you are evaluating between several very good potential suitors, the likelihood is that you're going to get a nice return on your role.
Well, Perrin, thank you so much. I hope for those of you that really understood what we were talking about and it really gets you going and it makes you think differently. And that's my hope. My hope is I want to create thought. I want your wheels to get spinning. Give Perrin a call, give Polaris Healthcare a call, and, you know, and if nothing else, pick his brain at least. And, you know, that's how things get started. So I want to thank everybody for tuning in this week, and we will see you guys next week.